In today's podcast, how liposuction makes you fat. Also, dealing with chronic calf sprain. What is PAP training? Can you create glycogen from fat and protein? Are unsoaked nuts and seeds a problem? The Maffetone versus the Dominator heart rate zones. Distances for long triathlon training sessions and reasons for fat loss resistance.
Welcome to the Ben Greenfield Fitness.com podcast. We provide you with free exercise, nutrition, weight loss, triathlon, and wellness advice from the top fitness experts in the nation. So whether you're an Ironman triathlete or you're just trying to shed a few pounds, get ready for non-run-of-the-mill, cutting-edge content from BenGreenfieldFitness.com.
Hey, everybody, this is Brock. Welcome you to another question-filled episode of the Ben Greenfield Fitness Podcast, where you ask the questions that everybody wants the answers to. And here's the man with all the answers.
You hope so.
Yeah.
We hope you've got good questions, and we hope even more that we've got decent answers.
We roll the dice every week on that.
I'm scrunched up in my office chair right now with two like bikes behind me, and they're on trainers, but basically the front wheel of my wife's bike is about 2 inches from my head right now. So if you hear bicycles, that's me thrashing about trying to make a little room for myself. My wife and I are starting to get ready for the triathlon season, and so we've got our spin bikes set up in my office, and we spin in front of her computer, which is next to my computer, you know, do a little suffer fest and spinnerville videos and whatnot. And so I right now have bikes literally like right behind me, so I'm feeling a little crowded.
All right, well, just don't stick your fingers in the moving spokes and you'll be fine. The only danger I'm in is I just finished off a big snack of blueberries and almonds, and that's a choking hazard. Like between the skins of the almonds and the skins of the blueberries, I'm like,
I have never in my life heard of those being a hazard, but good luck with that.
Special announcements.
Okay, so we've got some special announcements. I am certain. What do you want to tell the people about?
Articles this week that came out since last week's podcast at BenGreenfieldFitness.com. You may have heard on Friday the interview with Dr. Marion Nessel about food politics and how the food industry influences your nutrition and your health and food safety. It was an interesting interview, albeit short, and so I also posted a more comprehensive and excellent video with Dr. Nessel just talking more about how food lobbyists affect our food choices and basically, you know, how food politics work, at least here in America. And it's not too much different than the way that they work in other places like, you know, the UK and Australia. You know, they deal with some of the same issues. So worth taking a look at the video, even if you listen to the audio. You know, if you've got any extra time, throw that video on. And then I also posted the other day about how to get rid of a magnesium deficiency, just the ultimate guide to how to know if you're deficient and what to do about it in terms of transdermal and oral magnesium therapy and why you'd want to do it and how to do it. So
it's awesome. To celebrate that post, I've spent the last couple of days slathered in magnesium oil, or at least maybe not slathered in it, but the back of my knees, back of my elbows, my neck, shoulders.
Right.
It's been delightful.
Slathered in magnesium oil, choking on blueberry and almond skins. It's good visual.
This is spring in Canada.
So for people listening in on the day that this podcast comes out tomorrow, which is Thursday, March 15th, at noon Pacific time, is the Eating for Endurance webinar that I'm teaching. I will put a link to that in the show notes. It'll be about an hour long, and I'll be kind of going over everything you need to know for preparing for a long distance event, nutrition wise, and you know what to eat before and during that. I'll also be going over physiology quite a bit, kind of like the physiology of nutrition 101. So, What else? Brock, I found out this week, is going to be joining us. Him and his girlfriend is going to be joining us for, or are going to be joining us for the Thailand adventure coming up this winter. We've got, I think we've got 8 people right now signed up for that adventure. So, folks, there's 4 slots left if you want to get in on this thing. We're going to be doing 2 triathlons in Thailand. This is at the end of November / beginning of December. We're going to be visiting a few islands over there, hanging out, eating food, shopping, partying, just having a lot of fun. If you want to come along on that trip and get in on it, then go to the show notes for this podcast, podcast number 186, and we've got a link right there in the show notes so you can get in on the Thailand adventure, which you'll want to start planning for now in terms of plane flights and all that jazz. So, there's one other thing that I wanted to mention. By the way, Brock, are you working on your Thai?
I haven't yet, but I'm going to learn at least please and thank you. I assume you've been there a few times, so you probably have it down.
I have kap khun krap.
All right.
Your business, if you're listening and you've got a business, you want to get some big exposure for your business. I talked to my editor over at Macmillan Publishing the other day, and they want kind of like a title sponsor for my next book. And this thing is going to be huge. We're rolling out an enormous launch, and they're really honestly kind of lowballing in terms of the actual price that they'll take for a sponsor to get tons of banner ads on the site, podcast announcements, premium newsletter placements, a ton of stuff. One of the better deals in advertising. I thought about approaching them to advertise myself, but I think there'd be a conflict of interest there. So if you've got like a business in the fitness or nutrition sector, this is one of the best opportunities I've ever seen in terms of getting literally like tens of thousands of eyeballs a day on your product. And I will put the sponsor perks sheet as a link in the show notes so you can check it out. But huge opportunity if you've got a nutrition or fitness business and you want to kind of be the title sponsor of my next book. Really, really, really big amount of traffic you'll get. So that's it for the special announcements.
News flashes.
So things have been tearing up and lighting up and plussing up at Google Plus for the last couple of months, actually. But what do you want to highlight from there for us today?
Well, Google Plus is kind of like the mini blog version of Ben Greenfield Fitness. A few articles that came out there, and we'll put a link to any of these in the show notes if you want to find out more. One was about carob as an alternative to chocolate. Tastes a little bit different. It's interesting, though. It's just the fact that it's brown, I think, makes it taste more like chocolate. But it's got a lot of good minerals in it, you know, iron, vitamin B, magnesium. It's a good source of fiber. It's got a little bit of protein in there, ton of antioxidants and polyphenols. So it's a very, very kind of non-acidic alkaline food and great healthy alternative to chocolate to have around. And we went into a post about carob over at the Ben Greenfield Fitness Google Plus page. So the other things that came across this week on that page that were of interest was a look at injury rates among triathletes. And what they found was that, you know, people like Ironman triathletes, over distance triathletes, I know a lot of them listening to this show, most common injuries are low back, Achilles, and knees. And then for like shorter distance athletes, like sprint or Olympic distance triathletes, also knees were a huge site where injuries occurred, but also the calves, the hamstrings, and the low back. And interestingly, there was no association between cross training and reduction of risk of injury, simply because there was just so much overtraining going on in these triathletes that they studied. But it was interesting the difference between the two groups of triathletes as far as the areas that were injured. And they suggested that the enormous amount of Achilles tendon injury occurrence basically seem to be highly correlated to the amount to which the athletes did hill repeats and also did not stretch before cycling. So, you know, interesting study, and I think it's worth looking into.
Did the risks go up the more hills you did, or did the risks go down the more hills you did? As far up. As the Achilles, oh, okay.
Up, just based off of the shortening of that tendon as you're running uphill. So,
so it's really like most of the evidence is based on just overuse, mm-hmm. or repetitive.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that type of stuff a little bit in some of today's podcast questions about, you know, how to get away with training less and getting injured less. So, and then finally, last thing that I thought was interesting in terms of posts this week over at the Ben Greenfield Fitness Google Plus page was just some advice about why running at a cadence of about 90 works when you're running. In terms of minimizing your risk of injury and decreasing, you know, the amount of ground reaction force that you have to absorb and dissipate, and how to do it. So we'll put a link to the Google Plus over in the newsflash section of this week's show notes at bengreenfieldfitness.com.
I just wanted to start singing, I am Iron Man. You know, that's 90 beats per minute, that song.
Is it?
Yeah, so if you sing that in your head and just run to it, it's perfect.
Nice.
Let's face it, there are some organic foods that are just tough to get at your local grocery store, like grass-fed beef with no chemicals and no hormones, probiotic foods that haven't been heated and processed so much that all the probiotics are dead, or dairy products that aren't laced with antibiotics or growth hormones. The good news is that no matter how hard it is for you to find healthy organic foods locally, Ben Greenfield can get you what you need right now. Just visit bengreenfieldfitness.com/organic to get Ben's recommended foods delivered straight to your doorstep, and you can start eating healthy with no guesswork today. What are you waiting for? Go to bengreenfieldfitness.com/organic. Listener Q&A.
All right, so our first question is an audio question, and it comes from Jennifer.
This is Jennifer from Portland. I have been following your advice pretty closely for about a year now. As far as eating and exercise, I've done Marathon Dominator and PR'd twice on both of my marathons last year, so I loved that. My problem is that I still have this fat on my sides and stomach that I cannot get rid of. I would say I'm definitely at a good weight. It's just something that bothers me and is maybe not completely unsightly to anybody else, but I've had two pregnancies, one of which was twins, and it's just a stubborn area, and I haven't been able to lose it. And following your advice and eating, and I think I looked up everything on your website that relates to fat loss, and none of it's worked at this point. So I run about 5 days a week, and I weight lift twice a week, and stay away from processed foods and wheat and all of that. So I was just wondering, I saw a plastic surgeon who suggested liposuction, and I wanted to see what your take is on that, whether or not that is a last resort, or if maybe you think there is a last or another resort that I haven't resorted to yet. I have fears that liposuction will then cause a lot of loose skin, or will the fat maybe show up somewhere else? I've heard horror stories from people. Just wondering what your take is there ever a time when plastic surgery kind of is the last resort?
Oh, liposuction. Vacuuming out your guts.
Yeah, I like a good liposuction every now and then. but seriously, with liposuction, it's really, really important that you understand that removing adipose tissue – in that way, which is not obviously a physiologically natural way to remove adipose tissue, has some consequences. So they've done studies, first of all, on people who have gotten liposuction. So there was one study that was, I believe, published back in 2004, and that looked at the health effects of liposuction in a group of women. And what they did was they removed a bunch of the subcutaneous adipose fat in the abdominal region, very, very large amounts of fat. But what they found was that 12 weeks post-surgery, that all of the women who received liposuction did not show significant improvements in any of the things that tend to be highly associated with obesity and overweight, like insulin sensitivity, which is a precursor to diabetes, blood pressure, blood glucose levels, insulin levels, circulating fat levels. And these parameters actually were all of the bad things basically went up after 12 weeks, and none of the risks of disease went down. So it was almost as if sucking out a bunch of fat tissue somehow made these folks less healthy. And there was another study that looked at basically a group of folks that, again, got liposuction and didn't really make any lifestyle changes after liposuction, and they had their body fatness measured throughout the course of a year after receiving the liposuction. I was going to say liposuction. That may have been a more fitting term.
Yeah.
And what happened was that obviously, shortly after the liposuction group was much leaner than the control group that didn't receive liposuction. And after about 6 months, that difference was a lot less. And after 1 year, there was no statistically significant difference in the weight of the liposuction group versus the control group. And furthermore, the liposuction group actually had regained fat in the area where fat tends to be the most highly correlated with health issues, and that's in the visceral fat region, in the abdominal fat region. So that, again, was a pretty serious issue that indicated that not only may liposuction increase your risk of chronic disease, but also appears to be fairly non-efficacious in terms of keeping weight off. And when you do put weight back on, it tends to be in an area that's even more prone to causing issues in terms of metabolic issues than where you got the lipo or where you got the fat taken off in the first place. Like, you know, you can get it taken off your thighs, but it ends up back in your abdominal region, which is not a good thing. That's an even worse place to have the fat. There was another study that came out really recently, and that was in April of last year, and what that looked at was a group of women that received liposuction in their hip and lower ab and their thigh regions, and those were compared to a control group of women at a similar body fat percentage who didn't get liposuction. And the interesting thing about this was that the amount of fat, the amount of visceral fat that wound up, again, getting redistributed into the abdominal regions of the women who got the liposuction was much, much higher, or extremely high. It was like a 13% of the fat had been regained in that region. And it's really concerning to me, the metabolic damage and the redistribution of fat that liposuction can cause. And there's really a reason that occurs, and it has to do with adipose tissue. And fat cells have a really important physiological role in controlling your free fatty acid levels and your triglyceride levels. And they also produce many hormones that are hormones necessary for your normal metabolic processes. One of the hormones produced by adipose tissue is called leptin. And leptin is basically a hormone that can act on the receptors in what's called the hypothalamus region of your brain, and it inhibits appetite. So when you have good levels of leptin circulating, and you're sensitive to that leptin, and you're able to, you know, your cell surface receptors are able to interact with leptin, then you're able to control your appetite much, much better. So leptin is essentially like an appetite suppressant, and the absence of leptin or the absence of leptin receptors or an insensitivity to leptin can lead to uncontrolled food intake and is associated with obesity. And so when you remove adipose tissues, you remove a lot of that leptin signaling. You can also remove a lot of the effects of insulin sensitivity and the ability to produce insulin effectively when you remove adipose tissue, just again based on hormonal signaling. And so when you take all the adipose tissue out, you suddenly affect your appetite significantly, and specifically you can potentially decrease your ability to control your appetite. The other thing that you have to understand about adipose tissue is that it is a storage mechanism. It's the body's primary storage mechanism. So when you've got high levels of circulating blood glucose and blood sugar from a meal, and you have high levels of circulating fatty acids from a meal, the way that you store that type of thing is in adipose tissue, in your adipocytes. And so when you don't have a storage mechanism for that tissue, you get things like high blood sugar and high cholesterol in association with that high blood sugar, which means you've got a higher propensity for like oxidized blood cholesterol and heart disease risk, and you get a lot of metabolic dysregulation, basically because your body has had the natural storage mechanism kind of artificially removed. Now, interestingly, you know, like when you take somebody who has an actual disease where they lose their fat cells, not through liposuction, but through it's called lipodystrophy, where it's actually a disease where there's an abnormal death of fat cells. These people, similar to what you observe in liposuction, they get, you know, metabolic disease. They get like visceral fat formation, you know, forming in the deep abdominals, which is the most risky place to get fat. Fatty liver disease from the high amounts of triglycerides and fatty acids circulating in the bloodstream because they've got nowhere to go. Diabetes and all these metabolic issues. And you can control this somewhat, interestingly, by actually injecting these folks with leptin, which is one of the super important hormones that's made by fat tissue that can help to control some of these processes. But they're still in deep doo-doo from this loss of adipose tissues, this kind of non-natural loss of adipose tissue. What it comes down to is that the best way to get rid of adipose tissue is to put the body into a state where it's naturally relying upon the fat stored in the adipose tissue as an energy source. And that does mean that, you know, you're going to be controlling calories and exercising. As simple and as non-sexy a solution as that sounds, it is in almost every case going to be far more effective than liposuction, and far safer from a metabolic perspective, because once again this comes down to fat percentage and body weight not being the only parameter that influences your overall health and your longevity. So in this case, liposuction is more likely to make you sick and fat than it is to make you skinny and kind of whistling merrily along for the rest of your life.
So Jennifer mentioned in her question that she feels like she's at a good body weight and she has been following your advice really well, but she does still have this this abdominal. I can't remember. She said her sides and her stomach. What would you suggest that maybe she just needs to go a little harder, or maybe needs to reevaluate her goals?
Well, first of all, and this is something that, you know, when I was, you know, working with anywhere from 8 to 12 clients a day as a personal trainer, you know, every day of the week, this was probably the question I got most often was, you know, why am I not skinny and lean like I should be from all this work that I've been doing? And my initial response to that, you know, as insensitive as it may sound, was, well, how long did it take you to put this on? Hmm. I mean, you know, in many cases, if you've started a lifestyle of relative inactivity combined with unhealthy eating when you were 15 years old and 25, that's, you know, 10 years of putting adipose tissue and training your body how to store fat, you can't take it off necessarily with 2 years of hard work. Sometimes it can take just as long to take it off as it did to put it on. And that's just the way that the world works. So later on, because I know we have another question about kind of like, you know, how to get rid of that last little bit of fat, I'll go into more of the reasons that you might not be losing that fat as quickly as you possibly could, but liposuction would definitely not be the best solution in this case.
Yeah, I think you made that abundantly clear. If anybody had any question in their mind, don't do it.
All the people listening to this podcast while driving to your liposuction appointment, you can turn around.
Yeah, just pull over. Weep in the back seat for a while and go home. All right, I think we should move on to the next question here, and it's another audio question from Jake.
Hi, Ben and Brock. This is Jake from Philly. I'm 15 weeks now out from Ironman Coeur d'Alene and have an injury I'm trying to get over. I've got chronic calf strains that I've had since about October. I've tried a couple different things. I've taken a month completely off from running. I've tried some heel cups in my shoes. Some things that I've heard that I haven't tried yet are putting cork lifts in the shoes, as well as possibly compartment syndrome, which I've read a little bit about and doesn't sound good. You should know that I'm not running the new shoes. I did change last May from the Brooks Adrenaline to the Brooks ST5 Racer, so a more low-profile shoe, but I've been running it for about 5 months before I had any issues. I'm currently seeing an ART doctor, but that doesn't seem to be going in a good direction, so I'm wondering what else it could be or what else my options are. And my other question is, saying that I'm 15 weeks out from Ironman Coeur d'Alene, at what point would you as a coach say you're X weeks out from this race, you haven't run in X weeks, and you just can't prepare adequately for a race?
15 weeks out from Ironman, is it too late?
No, it's not too late. You know, I think it was pro triathlete Terenzo Bizzoni, and a pretty good New Zealand athlete, and he had I believe it was a chronic Achilles issue, and there was one race, it was either last year or the year before, where he didn't run at all, and it was for like 5 or 6 weeks or something like that before the race. I was reading about this somewhere. I'm sorry to be cryptic, but it's one of those things where I just don't remember where I saw it. And he ran a freaking fast half marathon during the 70.3 with, you know, very, very little running. You know, I had a similar issue when I raced the triathlon world championships several years ago. I had an IT band friction syndrome issue. I used some of the strategies that I'll outline here in a second, and very, very little running. You know, I didn't run super fast, but I did like a 126 or something like that during that event. And again, that was with minimal running due to an injury that just kind of took me out of the game leading up to the race. So first of all, when we look at detraining and, you know, the kind of use it or lose it type of principle, it's really like beginning athletes and people who are new to exercising that will – lose nearly all of their aerobic gains if they quit exercising. So if you've only been working out for, you know, a few months, in this case, like the study that was done on folks to look at how fast you lose aerobic gains, they had people, like new exercisers, do a fitness program for 2 months, so 8 weeks, and they made dramatic cardiovascular improvements. They boosted their aerobic capacity, and then they just had them quit exercising for 8 weeks. And when they came back, there was nothing left at all. You take the same folks and you do that same protocol to fit individuals, fit athletes, you know, somebody like Jake and, you know, an Ironman triathlete, and you tell them to stop exercising entirely, completely. And after 3 months, you only lose half of your aerobic conditioning. So you've got a lot of advantages just by being a fit person who's done something like an Ironman triathlon before in terms of slowing down that loss of fitness. Now, when you are ill, when you are injured, and you basically are able to work out less, there are certainly strategies that you can use. We'll get into calf-specific strategies in a second, but in most cases, intensity is going to trump volume when you're injured. Short, high-intensity exercise is going to cause really, really good aerobic adaptation. We talked about this last week, how literally it's about a 1-to-4 relationship, meaning that you can do, for every hour of high volume aerobic exercise that you do, you can get away with about 15 equivalent minutes of like high intensity interval training instead. So you're going to want to take any of your cross training that you're doing as an alternative to running, and you're going to want to make sure that you do it in a fairly intense manner. Now, the number one activity that I have personally used and I've found in the athletes that I coach to be the best thing for maintaining fitness when you've got a lower body injury like this and you have an event coming up is water running, without a doubt. I'm talking about deep water running where you can't touch the bottom of the pool, so there's no ground reaction forces going on, and you want to do the high-intensity version of water running.
So is that the one with the flotation device or without?
I like to use a flotation device, meaning a flotation belt, just because it allows you to focus more on pumping your arms and your legs and less on just like trying to manipulate your body in a manner that allows you to stay afloat.
Gotcha.
So you can go for longer and get better work for the legs done when you're wearing one of these aqua flotation belts. A lot of pools have them, and you can also go to any local sporting goods store and get one. You can get water running shoes, and the advantage of those is that they've got little fins on them that increase resistance. So I recommend getting a pair of those if you want to be able to boost your heart rate even higher and get a little bit more bang for your buck out of high-intensity intervals. Underwater MP3 player is, in
my
opinion, a plus, because water running is just freaking boring.
So boring.
It's more boring than running on a treadmill, I think.
Yeah.
But sample workout for something like training for a marathon. Sample workout for water running would be, first of all, to do it in a pre-fatigued state. So because you're already shorting yourself on volume for training for something like a marathon, you know, you'd want to have done like your cycling already earlier in the day or the day before. So you're your weight training or whatever else you're doing, so that you're really not running super fresh. So you're simulating the way you're going to feel when you get off the bike in Ironman anyways. And then you're going to do primarily higher intensity efforts, which work really, really well in running, because running is an isokinetic activity, meaning that the harder you push against the water, the harder it's going to push back against you. So the harder you sprint, the more efficacious a workout like that is going to be. What you can do is get in the water. You can warm up by jogging for about 5 to 10 minutes. And you're going to want to lean slightly forward. You're going to want to maintain a nice high cadence. And once you've warmed up and you're kind of breathing hard, one of my favorite things to do is just like 20 sprint repeats. So about half the length of the pool, because most of the pools I swim in, they start off shallow and then get deeper as you swim. So you start at about the point in the pool where you can't touch bottom, and then you sprint to the end of the pool, and then your recovery is turning around and jogging back. It'll take you about 20 to 30 seconds to sprint to the end of the pool. It'll take you about 50 to 60 seconds to kind of jog nice and easy back. Workout like that, you know, 20 repeats is going to kick your butt, I guarantee, and give you a big, big fitness boost when it comes to run-specific training. In addition to water running, elliptical trainer is kind of another solution. Sometimes that's phase two, where the calf has really started to heal, and now you can put a little bit more stress on it. But elliptical trainer is another great alternative, and you can even combine the two. I mean, you can do an elliptical trainer workout and then a water running workout, you know, as an alternative to doing your 15 to 20 mile run prep workout that you can't do because it's putting too much stress on the calf. So hopefully that gives you some ideas in terms of ways to stay fit. And we should also, of course, address the calf itself and why you keep straining it and what the issue might be. Number one issue I see with calves is overpronation. Faulty biomechanics, making your foot roll inwards, putting a bunch of excessive pressure on the calf muscles. And that can be addressed through the shoes. It sounds like Jake was changing up his shoes a little bit already. But I would look into getting like a biomechanical video analysis at your local physical therapist or your local friendly running store and look at yourself running from the back, watch your foot in slow-mo, see how much you're rolling over from a foot strike, to basically toe off, how much you're rolling over to the inside of the foot, how much you're rolling the foot inwards after the foot strikes. And if it's excessive, then there are a few things that should be addressed. It can start with the shoes and maybe even looking into getting your foot casted and getting a custom orthotic. I actually uploaded a video to the youtube.com/Ben Greenfield Fitness page about this yesterday, about running orthotics and how to get your foot custom casted to get running orthotics that are built for your style. But in addition to orthotics, you can go up your kinetic chain and look at things like your hip mobility. That's a big, big one when it comes to something higher up in your body affecting overpronation. The movement of your sacroiliac joint in your lower back/hip region, the amount of tightness in your IT band causing lack of hip mobility, a potential for lack of knee mobility, which can affect the pronation of the foot, and even the strength of the hip flexors, the ability of yourself to actually pick the leg up the ground or up off the ground, weak hip flexors or chronically shortened hip flexors from spending long periods of time sitting can both also aggravate overpronation. So those are things that could have caused this issue in the first place. And remember that as you train, the body can change. Like you can not change anything. You can just start riding your bike more. And the act of riding your bike more and spending a bunch of time spent hunched over on your bike can lead to immobility in the hip, which can lead to overpronation when you're running, which can lead to a repetitive calf strain that wasn't really caused by you changing much at all with your running program. So understand that there's lots of variables at play here. So we've talked about what might cause a chronic repetitive calf strain like this. We've talked about ways that you might be able to stay fit, and you certainly can at your point 15 weeks out, you could go for the next you could go all the way up to 4 weeks from Ironman just doing like elliptical trainer and aqua jogging, and you'd still be okay. But the last thing is things that are going to speed up healing. I talk so much about supplements and stuff on this show and about, alternative methods to heal, but I'll talk about the two biggest things I would look into if I had a calf strain, the two things that I would consider most. One would be a pulsed electromagnetic field therapy. It's called PEMF. So PEMF basically uses electrical energy to direct these magnetic pulses into injured tissue. And that magnetic pulse sends this little electrical signal that can stimulate or speed up cell repair. And it can also suppress inflammation. It can alleviate pain. It can increase range of motion. So I would recommend that you look into finding a local physician, like a rehabilitative physician, or even like a like an alternative medical clinic, anything like that that has access to a pulsed electromagnetic field therapy unit. And I would do some PEMF treatments on the calf. I would certainly look into that. The other thing that I would consider, and it's going to depend on the location of the calf strain, but I would consider prolotherapy. And prolotherapy is a treatment where you inject what's called a proliferant, which is something that makes something grow or expand. Typically, it's something like a sugar solution or a solution of like vitamins and some other compounds that gets injected into the site. Usually, this is going to be if it's an area that's a little bit closer to bone. So this would probably be like lower down if your calf strain is a little bit lower. Or if it's potentially near the knee. And when you inject a natural substance into the soft tissue, it can trigger a healing response. And for example, the physician who's been on this show before down in Florida, Dr. David Minkoff, these are two methods I know that he uses quite a bit with the athletes that he works with to take care of chronic repetitive motion injuries and repetitive strain injuries. So, you know, and that guy really, really knows what he's talking about, what he's doing. He's done like, you know, something like 40 Ironman triathlons, and he knows the game. He's a fan of these, and I would definitely recommend that you look into these as potential treatments as well. So that's what I would say to Jake in terms of where to start. And I would certainly say to, at this point, definitely stay in the game. But just quit running, period. Don't try to fight this with heel cups and this other stuff. I would just stop running, because if it's just like a grade one calf strain, and it just keeps getting tripped up from you running on it, it's going to heal within anywhere from about 4 to 6 weeks. And that still leaves you with, you know, another good, 10 weeks to train. So
awesome. Well, there you go, Jake. Get out there and kick some butt. All right, our next question comes from Eric. Eric says, I've been hearing a lot about PAP training and was hoping you could help define what it is and how it may help endurance athletes.
PAP training, yes. So PAP, or PAP, that stands for post-activation potentiation. So basically, in a nutshell, what it means is you lift something really heavy and then you go do whatever it was that you were going to do, and that heavy lifting that you did helps you to use more muscle. Okay, that's the basic idea behind it. So the underlying principle behind this is that when you load a muscle prior to an activity, you can get a bunch of central nervous system stimulation that causes you to recruit more motor units at the muscle level and produce more force. And that effect can stay with you, based on research, from anywhere from 5 minutes up to 30 minutes after you've lifted the heavy object or produced the activity that causes you to recruit more motor units and produce a higher amount of force. So the way that this probably works, there's a couple ways that it could work, but the way that it probably works is that when you lift the heavy object, you get more of what's called phosphorylation, or addition of phosphate to one part of, or one fiber that moves along the muscle during a contraction. That's your myosin fiber. And what happens is this allows for more of actin, the other fiber, the other protein that's involved in muscle contraction, to bind to this myosin. So you're using more of your muscle fibers. And when you get a bunch of calcium ions released, which is what happens when your nerves send a signal to your muscle to contract, the more phosphorylation that's occurred on the muscle fiber level, the more the muscle can respond to that calcium release by producing a greater amount of force. So you essentially are changing up the physiology of your muscle by increasing what's called phosphorylation when you lift a heavy object prior to engaging in something like a sprint or an explosive jump or something like that. There may also be a little bit of an excitation of a spinal reflex, meaning that, you know, your spine sends a signal to your muscle via your muscle nerves to fire, And by lifting something heavy, it may produce basically a reflex reaction that causes your spine to either inhibit the muscle less or cause a more excitatory signal to be sent to the muscle. So either way, you know, ultimately, who cares how it happens, but it works.
That was very interesting.
Yeah, with explosive athletes, this works really, really well. So it's just based off of the percentage of fast twitch muscle fibers. Fast twitch muscle fibers respond really, really well to this phosphorylation. They respond really well to a heavy loading prior to doing something like engaging in a maximum vertical jump or a sprint. So how this would flesh itself out would mean that you do like a few reps of heavy squat, you know, about 15 minutes before you're going to go do a sprint or a ski jump or, you know, or a boxing match or something that's requiring a high amount of explosive force. And that preconditioning load is basically used to prepare you for that activity. And that's how you would use post-activation potentiation kind of on a practical level. With slow twitch athletes, this doesn't seem to work quite as well, you know, like a triathlete or an endurance athlete, because post-activation potentiation is, again, more effective with fast twitch muscle. They actually have done a study on this with triathletes, though, and what they had them do was a maximum isometric contraction of the elbows and the ankles. And so that means that they would just like squeeze for 5 seconds as hard as possible the elbow muscles or the ankle muscles, depending on which effect they were training. And what they found was that there was a post-activation potentiation effect, and it could slightly enhance endurance performance by offsetting fatigue. But it only happens in the muscle groups that you did the post-activation potentiation for. So technically what this means is that it's possible that like prior to a swim, like contracting your muscles really hard for 5 seconds and then releasing them and then contracting them again and then releasing them and doing that a handful of times before you head out for like the swim and a triathlon could help you swim faster, or doing that same thing except doing it, you know, like a few squat jumps before a 5K or a 10K, or even just like maximally contracting your calves or maximally contracting your quads. That may also allow for a little post-activation potentiation effect. It's just that, you know, research in terms of actual, you know, total time to fatigue or how much it's going to help you is a little bit scarce, but it might have an effect. And with weight training, this stuff's really fun because you can basically pair a heavy exercise with an explosive exercise. And this is called complex training. And, you know, I do some of this where you, for example, can go do a set of barbell squats in the gym and, you know, use a fairly heavy weight that's causing a good maximum contraction. And then you follow that up with a plyometric exercise, like a depth jump or jumping up onto a box or a single leg hop. And you'll be able to recruit more muscles and create more explosiveness with the exercise that you do after you've done the heavy lifting. And the cool thing about that is that that has a direct performance effect because essentially what you're doing is, you know, the same thing as you'd be doing if you like took creatine before you'd go work out, creatine phosphate, which in a similar manner allows for greater phosphorylation in your muscles. What you're doing is you're allowing yourself to do maybe a couple extra reps, or you're allowing yourself to produce more force with the reps that you do. And so there's a training effect when you finally do end up going out and doing your event that you're training for. So for example, if you do a set of heavy squats and then you go do a set of plyometrics and you're able to produce more explosiveness from the plyometrics because you did the heavy squats beforehand, then the increased explosiveness that you were able to produce from the plyometrics may help you with that 5K that you're training for 2 weeks later. So, you know, there certainly is some benefit to post-activation potentiation. I think the greater amount of the benefit is going to come from using this in your training sessions more than it's going to come from, like, you know, doing an isometric contraction as you're, you know, standing on the starting line of an event. But ultimately, it's cool stuff.
Yeah, it is. That's very cool stuff. I've never heard of that before. That was That sounds kind of cool. I wonder if I wonder if my coach might add some of that stuff into my training plan.
You are going to see that as you're getting to the plyometric phase. Basically, there are some workouts that I prescribe. By the way, for those of you listening in, I'm Brock's coach.
That wasn't obvious.
That wasn't clear. So you'll find that you'll be hitting the weight room a few times for some plyometric sessions that actually use this principle. Yeah, I generally work those in about 4 to 8 weeks prior to the race.
Very cool. Okay, our next question comes from Andre. Andre says, I keep hearing about after a workout that you have to eat to replenish the glycogen storage. Also, during a long training run or race, you have to ingest carbs to top up your glycogen storage. My question is, if you can do this with fat or protein instead of carbs, can I just eat fat and protein after a workout to restore my glycogen levels? How about during a workout?
That's a good question. You know, can fats or proteins be turned into glycogen for muscle? And just to connect the dots here, glycogen is basically a bunch of glucose molecules that are connected together in this branch that forms like this, you know, branchy type of starch. And that is the form of storage carbohydrate that you're going to find, for example, in your body's liver or in your muscles. And when your blood glucose levels are low, and you don't have large amounts of dietary carbohydrate coming in while you're performing an activity that relies on carbohydrate as a fuel, your body mobilizes this glycogen. It breaks it down. It's released into the body where it is basically, you know, found as blood glucose, and that blood glucose gets turned into energy for ATP. So you can basically, if we look at fat, For starters, fat molecules or lipids, those can be basically turned into glucose. So that's called gluconeogenesis. You know, when you take fat and you turn it into glucose, or when you take protein and you turn it into glucose. And the way that it happens with fats is that fats can be broken down to form a molecule that's called glycerol. And through a series of biochemical reactions, glycerol can get converted into glucose molecules. And the issue is it's very unlikely that those glucose molecules are going to be used for glycogen synthesis or stored away. And the reason for that is that glycogen is typically made when blood glucose levels are high and carbohydrate energy is in abundance. And so when you have an excess of glucose in the body, the amount of glucose in the liver goes up, and that triggers glycogen synthesis in the liver, and then also glycogen getting transported to skeletal muscle to boost the energy reserves in skeletal muscle. But the conditions under which fat would be turned into glycogen are quite different than the conditions under which like dietary carbohydrate would be converted into glycogen. Typically, when you're storing away energy, it's because you have an energy excess coming in. So this is why we carbohydrate load the week before we do something like a triathlon or an endurance event, because we're giving the body energy excess and it's taking that energy and converting it into storage energy that we can rely on upon a later date. But when you are consuming fats, typically your blood glucose levels are somewhat lower, and there's less of a signal to your body that it needs to store away glycogen or store away energy. And in an ideal scenario, if you're eating a high-fat diet, it's not in energy excess, because at that point, the high-fat diet isn't really doing you much good. You're just going to make yourself fat. So what this comes down to is that the conditions under which you would be able to take the glucose that you make from fat and convert it into glycogen are not conditions that you'd normally be under. And so that'd be a really, really inefficient way to make storage energy. In this case, carbohydrates would just be a better, more efficient way to go if what you want to do is make muscle glycogen or make liver glycogen. protein can also get converted into glucose in the body. You know, protein is basically, you know, very, very similar to carbohydrates, except it has a nitrogen group on it. And so when you deaminate protein or you remove that nitrogenous part, protein can be easily converted into glucose. And theoretically, that too could be stored away as glycogen. But by using protein as your method of making storage carbohydrate, you're causing a bunch of nitrogen to be released. And so the metabolic effects of like a high protein, low carbohydrate diet can put you at risk of a lot of these issues that happen when you're creating a lot of nitrogen and getting a lot of the byproducts of protein release. For example, you know, you've got a lot greater like calcium excretion, and so you have a higher risk of kidney stones. You can basically increase your risk of renal insufficiency just because of all the nitrogenous byproducts that are having to be broken down and removed from metabolizing protein as your primary energy source. And, you know, even though you could technically get as much glucose as you actually need from proteins and fats, it's just biochemically not the best way to be like storing away storage glycogen. So when it comes to replenishing your body's carbohydrate stores post-exercise so that you can have carbohydrates to rely on for the next exercise session, from a biochemical standpoint and the way that your body works, just eating carbohydrates post-exercise is the best, most efficient way to do that. Fats don't get converted into glycogen very efficiently because when you're consuming fats, usually it would be because carbohydrates are not present and blood glucose is low, and proteins get converted into glycogen a little bit more efficiently, or could get converted into glycogen a little bit more efficiently, but then you're having to deal with all the nitrogen buildup that happens when you're using that as your strategy. So I see absolutely no reason that you would want to basically build muscle storage from proteins or fats instead of from carbohydrates, unless you've somehow been convinced that a low carbohydrate diet is the best way to go, even post-exercise. And post-exercise is one of the times when it's not the best way to go, just because you're insulin sensitive and the carbohydrate isn't going to cause the same issues that it would when you're in a state of inactivity. So ultimately, have your carbohydrates after the workout. Rely on primarily fats and moderate amounts of protein during the times that you're not in your workout state, and that's the best way to go.
Well, he did ask about, also asked about doing the same thing during a workout, and I think your answer kind of fills in that information as well. It's just not an efficient way to go.
Well, if you're working out in a low intensity manner, then you can burn free fatty acids as a fuel. And you can also metabolize amino acids from protein as a fuel, but you're not eating the fats and proteins to make storage muscle glycogen. You're eating them to directly metabolize them. So yeah, you can eat them during a workout, but it's not so that you store away muscle glycogen. If you want to store away muscle glycogen during a workout, eat carbohydrates.
Exactly. So. Yeah. All right. Excellent. Well, next question comes from Hosanna. And Hosanna says, to what degree does eating unsoaked nuts and seeds affect the bioavailability of the nutrients? I was eating a dried fruit and nut and seed mix daily as a significant portion of my diet until I read to limit intakes substantially on the Paleo Diet Lifestyle website.
Yeah, that's because of phytates. So phytic acid is something you're going to find in beans and seeds and nuts and grains. Usually you're going to find it in like the bran or the outer hull. And what that phytic acid does is it's where the grain has phosphorus locked up in it, the mineral phosphorus. And the way that a phytic acid molecule is built is it's got all these little branches or these little arms that come off it. And at the end of each of those arms is a basically a hydroxy like a hydroxy endpoint, an oxygen and a hydrogen molecule stuck together. And that tends to attract a lot of minerals, all of those little end chains in phytic acid. So you've got phosphorus bound up inside the phytic acid, and when you consume these foods with a bunch of phytic acids, what happens is a lot of minerals tend to bind to the phytic acid. So you don't get like zinc and magnesium and all these other minerals well absorbed from your diet when you're eating foods that are high in phytic acids. Seeds and bran are the highest source of phytates. You're also going to find some phytates in like cocoa beans and chocolate and coffee beans. But really, like seeds and bran, you know, beans, seeds, nuts, and grains are going to be the highest sources of phytates. And a high phytate diet, because of the way phytate is built, can result in mineral deficiencies. And you'll see this in populations where cereal grains are providing a major source of calories. Studies have shown that mineral deficiency-related diseases like rickets and osteoporosis are fairly common. And in folks who are looking for a higher performance lifestyle, the fact that minerals are an integral part of most of the metabolic reactions that take place within your body should give you cause for concern if you have a lot of phytates in your diet. So there are things that you can do, of course, to make phytic acid digestible or to cause it to cause less mineral blocking or blocking mineral absorption. So there's an enzyme called phytase. And phytase is what neutralizes phytic acid, kind of opens it up, and it liberates that phosphorus mineral that's inside the phytic acid. And you're going to find phytase in plant foods that contain phytic acid. They just naturally are found in plant foods. You're also going to find higher levels of phytase in animals that rely on grains. Their bodies naturally produce this phytase enzyme that breaks down phytic acid. So you'll find a lot of phytase in like a ruminant animal, like a cow or a sheep or a goat, because they're grazing on, you know, grains and grasses and seeds. And they got to have this phytase so that all these grains and grasses and seeds aren't stripping the minerals from that. Excuse me. I'm sure that sounded attractive. So the phytic acid isn't stripping all the minerals from these animals' bodies. Even mice they produce like 30 times more phytase than humans. And, you know, mice are grabbing seeds and nuts and things like that off the ground all the time. So they need to be able to break down that phytic acid. Humans don't produce a ton of phytase. If you've got a really, really good level of probiotics and a lot of good flora in your stomach, that's going to produce some phytase. So that certainly helps out a little bit with you being able to digest foods that have a lot of phytic acid in them. But humans generally need to do other things to the food to activate the phytase enzyme in the food and reduce the phytic acid in the food. And there are things that you can do. So, for example, when you soak a grain or you soak a flour in an acid medium at a warm temperature, that activates phytase. That's why sourdough bread is one of the breads that I will consume, because a lot of that phytic acid has been reduced or eliminated. You're going to find that soaking and sprouting and germinating can, in most cases for most grains, help out quite a bit. And as far as the actual percentage to which you're going to increase the mineral availability and decrease the activity of the phytates, it really, really depends based on the grain. So quinoa is going to be different than oats is going to be different than grains, etc. But it's extremely significant the amount to which soaking and sprouting and germinating can activate the natural phytase enzymes in seeds and grains and nuts and grasses and cause you to be able to digest that phytic acid containing food. So, you know, there are some treatment processes that actually can completely destroy the natural phytase that is found in a grain. And one of those methods is heat processing, which you're going to find in pretty much every breakfast cereal that's out there on the market. And so there are some foods that are simply impossible for you to eat without getting tons of phytic acid. And like, you know, cereals are one of those, like commercially produced cereals. You could take the same ingredients that are in those cereals and you could soak them and you could sprout them and you could germinate them. I mean, these are a lot of the things that my wife and I teach inside the Ben Greenfield Fitness Inner Circle. We make videos and put information on the forum and basically teach folks, you know, how to make this food digestible. But yeah, there are some foods where it's just like you just can't eat them because you can't treat them that way. And that would be like breakfast cereals. Now, the other interesting thing is that they have found in studies that a higher amount of calcium consumption can actually help out quite a bit when you are consuming large amounts of grains or seeds or grasses. And that may be a lot of times why you'll find in agriculture that, you know, the consumption of or the production of, like, you know, cheeses and yogurts and milks and preferably raw natural dairy compounds can actually decrease a lot of the damage that, you know, consuming something like a high phytic acid containing food would normally cause. So, you know, that's why it'd be okay to have, like, you know, a piece of fermented sourdough bread with some raw milk cheese and, you know, some butter and a little bit of meat. I mean, that's fine to have as a meal. You aren't going to really get much risk of phytic acid because of that. So another strategy that you can use when you're eating these soaked and sprouted and germinated, you know, seeds and grains and grasses, et cetera, is to also include some natural dairy on the side. You know, get your hands on some yogurt and some raw milk and some good natural cheese and stuff like that. And that helps out quite a bit as well. So I hope that kind of gives some direction to Hosanna, but ultimately, you know, that dried fruit, nut, and seed mix that you're eating, it's probably, I'm guessing, not at least soaked, those seeds and nuts. So I would say, you know, you may want to look back to identifying the seeds and nuts that are in your nut and seed mix, and then just Google how to soak them, how to sprout them, how to germinate them, and you can teach yourself how to do that.
Well, we always have one question that revolves around delicious food. And it mm-hmm. always comes right in the middle of the episode when it's not time to eat yet.
I know. I hate that. Sort of I never eat breakfast before we record just because it's too early. I don't roll out of bed and eat breakfast. I just don't do it. And yeah, I get hungry while we're doing this podcast sometimes when people ask questions like that and I got to talk about sourdough bread, fresh cooked and warm with raw cheese. All right, let's move on. Let's find a non-food question.
Okay. JeffyT01, interesting name, says, I listened to your podcast with Phil Maffetone, and I was wondering what your thoughts are on his 180 formula versus how you lay out your heart rate training zones in your Dominator plan. Also, do you need to do more volume when using Maffetone's method?
So in the Dominator plan at triathlondominator.com, I do include frequent testing in that plan. And the testing that you're doing is what's called a lactate field test, where you're going out and you're exercising at your maximum sustainable pace for 20 to 30 minutes. And then you're subtracting the average heart rate that you experienced during that test. You're subtracting about 15 to 20 beats from that heart rate. And that correlates really, really well to what would be your maximum fat-burning heart rate, or what is called your aerobic threshold. And I have specific sessions that you do in the protocol of that Ironman training program where you will go out and you'll do like a two-hour bike ride where you're just at that heart rate the whole time, at that aerobic threshold, kind of maximum fat-burning zone the whole time. And that heart rate that you are finding, you know, by doing your lactic threshold and then subtracting 15 to 20 beats, it's very, very similar to Maffetone's 180 formula, which is essentially going after looking at a similar number. If you want to find out what that 180 formula is and how it's laid out and everything, just go to BenGreenfieldFitness.com and do a search for the word Maffetone. And I've interviewed Phil and we've talked about that. But it's just kind of a more kind of a quicker way to find out where your aerobic training threshold is than doing the test that I have people do in the Dominator. But the test that I prescribe in Dominator is it's more accurate and more personalized to your body.
And it's now, one hell of a workout too.
It is a good workout. Now here is where I think that some people kind of get confused. Knowing where your maximum fat burning heart rate is, which is really your money zone for endurance sports, because, you know, if you're going to go out and try and last 10 hours, then, you know, ideally you want to find the point where you're at your maximum fat burning zone, because we've all got, you know, 30,000, 40,000, 50,000 calories of storage fat that we can burn. And so if we're working out at our maximum fat burning efficiency, we're minimizing the extent to which we're going to burn through all our storage carbohydrate, and we are using the most efficient form of fuel possible that's on our body. Now, that doesn't mean that all of our training is done in that zone. And the reason for that is because you can speed up fitness gains in other areas, like your VO2 max and your muscle power and force and your speed and your turnover, by doing harder workouts, by doing interval training. And so some people will take the whole idea of, you know, Maffetone's 180 formula or my formula for finding your fat burning heart rate zone, and they'll say, okay, I've got that zone, I'm just going to go out and do every session in that zone. And so, you know, every day, 2 to 3 hours of steady running in that zone, or steady swimming in that zone, or steady cycling in that zone. And that's really not the most efficient way to go about training. Instead, my recommendation is when you're kind of in your main Ironman preparation or your main marathon preparation or half hour, whatever it is that you're training aerobically to do, that you just do one workout per sport or per skill at that heart rate. Where, yeah, you're hopping on your bike and you're riding for 2 or 3 hours at your maximum fat burning heart rate zone, or you're doing a 90-minute run at your maximum fat burning zone, or you're doing a, you know, 45-minute steady swim in that aerobic zone. But most of the other sessions, just to maximize the efficiency of time that you have and to work on other fitness parameters that go above and beyond just your fat burning zone, you're doing interval training and, you know, sprint workouts and hill repeats and stuff that take you up higher at a higher intensity than that zone. And that's really the ultimate way to train, especially if you're pressed for time and you don't have, you know, 20, 25, 30, 35 hours a week to just be like, you know, getting up every day and doing all your training in your fat burning heart rate zone. So part of it is time availability and efficiency, and part of it is training muscle systems and energy systems that go above and beyond just that fat burning energy system, because you certainly also need things like, you know, the ability to maintain a high cadence and the ability to produce a lot of force and the ability to have enough strength to where your joints are protected and, you know, things that go above and beyond just doing all your training in that one heart rate training zone. So hopefully that kind of gives you a little bit of an understanding of the difference between, you know, like my formula and other people's formulas and how much volume you'd actually need to do. You know, for me, for training for an Ironman, using my formula, you know, or something like you'd find in triathlondominator.com, you're generally training about 10 to 15 hours a week. And, you know, for most folks, you can go at least 10 hours doing that. You know, I range from 9.5 to 10 hours using that method for something like an Ironman triathlon.
Cool. Well, speaking of that, speaking of those 9 to 12 or 15 hours of training, Jack asks, in training for different triathlon distances, what distances would you recommend for long swim, long ride, and long run? Also, what sort of bricking do you recommend most? I'm especially interested in the Olympic triathlon distance.
So bricking, by the way, for those of you who haven't heard that term before, it typically refers to doing a bike followed by a run. Okay, so training for long distances. This is pretty straightforward. If you want to do a sprint distance triathlon, you should be able to, and I'm going to give you a range here, and the more advanced you are, the more time you have, and the more you want to focus on kind of like your over-distance training and being able to have a lot of muscular endurance, even when you're getting towards the end of a specific part of the race, you're going to choose the higher end of the spectrum. But for a sprint distance triathlon, you should be able to swim for your long workout about 400 to 1,000 meters. You should be able to bike 10 to 20 miles, and you should be able to run 2 to 5 miles. Sprint distance triathlons tend to kind of vary in their distance, but generally it's about a 500-meter swim, about a 12-mile bike, about a 3-mile run, around in that range. So for Olympic distance triathlons, I recommend you be able to kind of have your long swim be about 1,500 to 2,500 meters. You should be able to have your long bike be about 20 to 30 miles, and your long run about 5 to 8 miles. For a half Ironman triathlon, you should be able to swim about 2,000 to 3,500 meters for your long swim. Your long bike, about 40 to 60 miles. And your long run, about 10 to 14 miles. And then for something like an Ironman triathlon, about 3,500 up to around 5,000 meters for your long swim. About 80 up to 120 miles for your long bike. And anywhere from 17 up to about 22 miles for your long run. Like my first Ironman that I did, my long swim was about, I think it was about 3,000, right around in there. My long bike was about 70 miles, and my long run was right around 18.
You Americans are so confusing. You measure the pool in meters, but everything else in miles.
I know. But the reason I'm saying miles is just because that's what I live with here where I live. So my apologies to you meter folks and Canadians. But yeah, it's really, really going to vary. But those are ballparks. And most people do too much volume training and try and get a lot of folks will try and, be able to swim 4,000 meters straight and hard, be able to bike 112 miles straight and hard, and be able to run 26.2 miles, not all in a row, but they try and be able to do all that before the race. You generally need to be able to do about 75% of what you're going to do in the race to be able to feel pretty decent during the event. Remember that humans are aerobic animals. We're really, really good at endurance. We can outrun a horse if we need to, or any other animal on the face of the planet. And the ability to go long is not our weakness. Typically, our weakness is the ability to have high turnover, the ability to produce large amounts of force, the ability to go fast. So my philosophy is always kind of prioritizing those elements in training and trusting the human body's innate endurance and the ability to go long as an adaptive response to even something like anaerobic training or interval training. And that works really well for me, and it also allows me to have a life when training for something like Ironman. As far as my favorite brick workouts or like combined workouts, one workout that I like to do is like a hard swim workout, like a swim interval-based workout, like hundreds and 200s and 500s, a good hard workout that leaves your arms a little bit rubbery, followed by kind of a more of like that fat-burning zone bike that I described. So you get out of the water. For me, like I'll swim at the YMCA, my bike's parked outside, run into the locker room, change, and head out for like a longer bike, like a two-hour bike after doing a hard like 4K swim. So that's an example of a good brick workout. I also like to do like shorter bike run repeats. So what I mean by that, for example, is by the way, Brock, you still with me?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yep. Good. Want to make sure. Sorry. For a second there, I had the fear I was talking into dead air. So bike run repeats. What I mean by that is, like, you know, last weekend I went to the health club and I did a 1,000 meter row and then a 3 mile bike and then a 1 mile run. And I went through that five times. And that's an example of, like, you know, a brick workout where I really break things up and allows for a higher intensity on each of the different skills. You know, the row kind of stimulates the swim, and you can go through it as a circuit. And a lot of times it's a lot more interesting than just, like, you know, biking for, you know, an hour and a half and then running for 45 minutes. And then the other workout that works really well is to go on a long bike, like, you know, hop into one of your local Century rides, or, you know, put in a real, real long bike day. And this is something I'll generally try and throw in about three or four times before something like an Ironman triathlon. Then you follow that up with a short run. So I never, ever do long runs off the bike. And by long runs, I mean anything longer than an hour. The longest run you ever do off the bike should be like 59 minutes. So in most cases, you really don't need to do much more than that. Very, very few situations where you'd need to. And the shorter run off the bike at a decent intensity really trains your body just how to run fatigued. And I also try and throw that in as a key workout a few times before something like an Ironman triathlon. But those are some of my favorite bricks: doing a tough swim workout, then an easy bike, doing like real, real short bike run repeats or row bike run repeats, and then doing a long bike with a short run.
Okay. So our last question here comes from Josh. And Josh says, I'm a Cat 1 cyclist, really pushing myself this year to get some big results. I'm 25 years old. My coach has me doing some solid high-intensity intervals and some longer endurance rides, and my fitness is much higher than previous years. He lists a bunch of supplements that he's taking, and he says, my coach and I are obviously working to bring the watts up, but I'm struggling to get my weight down. I've been stuck between 170 and 173 pounds and 10% body fat forever. He's getting frustrated. He'd like to break that barrier. He's counted calories, went paleo over the last few years, and gluten-free, and was very pleased to find that he was following your food pyramid decently when you published it. So he says, I've had some blood work done and everything's normal. I just can't figure out how to lose the stubborn weight so I can get down to 7 to 8% body fat for my first races. Any suggestions?
Yeah. You know, kind of similar to Jennifer's question, you know, in the beginning, you've got this body fat. It seems like you're doing everything and it just won't go away. And certainly people, I would say, you know, some people have more of an uphill battle than others. You know, everybody based on their genetics have different levels of essential fat. And essential fat is what your body needs for normal physical and physiological function. And so, you know, genetics are the biggest determinant when it comes to your level of everything from obesity to just body fat distribution. So understand that you can't necessarily compare yourself to other guys on the starting line beside you. But as I mentioned, there are potential reasons that you could not be losing weight as quickly as you feel like it should, like you should be losing it based off of what you're doing. Most of them come down to hormonal issues or physiological issues. I know that Josh mentioned that he's gotten blood work done, but a lot of times typical blood work that you're going to get when you walk into the doctor's office is, like, you know, red blood cells, white blood cells, cholesterol numbers, and, you know, like a few other metabolic variables that a lot of times don't give you the full picture when it comes to why you may not be losing weight. So, for example, one big thing would be the activity of your thyroid gland, which can significantly affect your metabolism and your fat loss. And the reason that I mention this for Josh is that active individuals, highly competitive individuals, they tend to have lots of stress in their lives. And stress is a really significant contributor to thyroid dysfunction. And that can be stress from work. It can be lack of sleep. It can be stress from exercise. It can even be stress from blood sugar fluctuations due to you know, eating lots of foods to support your cycling adventures. So What happens, though, is that stress can cause hypothyroidism or reduced thyroid functioning because it can disrupt what's called your hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis or your HPA axis. And what that means is, in a nutshell, that this HPA axis is tied intimately to the amount of adrenal hormones that you're causing your adrenals to churn out from your high-stress lifestyle. And your HPA axis can, in response to that, downregulate your thyroid function. And that can reduce the amount of T4 that you convert to T3. So even if on your blood test your T4 numbers are just fine, that doesn't mean it's getting converted very well. And it can also result in hormone imbalances like chronic cortisol elevations. And that chronic cortisol elevation can cause fluid retention and stress-related fat deposition, wherever you tend to deposit fat. It can also reduce your liver's ability to clear excess estrogen, which can be a big issue in females more than males and in the inability to lose weight. But it creates basically this vicious cycle where you're stressed out, it affects your thyroid function, and a dysfunctional thyroid causes even more stress and a greater number of hormonal imbalances. Now, you would know if you had the type of adrenal stress that could cause hypothyroidism if, for example, you're having a lot of trouble with sleeping, like falling asleep, staying asleep, waking up, mood swings, food cravings like sugar and caffeine especially, irritability or lightheadedness or getting really low energy between the meals that you do eat, feeling fatigued a lot, getting headaches, getting sick a lot. All of these things can indicate a level of stress that could be a significant contributor to your thyroid dysfunction. So I would certainly look into your stress levels and try and control them as much as possible. Get adequate sleep. You know, reduce the amount of light that you're exposing yourself to at night so that you do get adequate sleep, and reduce as many stressors in your life as possible. If you haven't always, you know, eaten healthy, you can certainly potentially be in a state where your cell surface receptors are insensitive to insulin. Or maybe you have a little bit of leptin resistance going on. And either of these issues can be issues if you've ever been on a standard American diet for long periods of time where you're eating, you know, a high amount of processed or sugar-laden foods. And you may need to look into like the type of supplements that could improve your insulin sensitivity, you know, like getting on some chromium or some vanadium, or just really, really focusing, you know, even if you're doing, like you said, a paleo diet, on really only getting starches in, you know, immediately before, during, or after your cycling workouts. And that can be helpful in helping you to burn fat as well. I mentioned that hypothyroidism can have an effect on your hormones, but other things can have an effect on your hormones too. And even if you're 25 years old, you could have low testosterone just because you're exercising so much and so hard that you're stripping a lot of the hormonal building blocks from ever being able to create hormones in the first place. And the stress can also affect your ability to produce testosterone. So I would look into, you know, like go to bengreenfieldfitness.com and read the post that I did about, you know, how I boosted my testosterone. It's called something like, you know, I admit to taking performance enhancing drugs. And you can look into things like D-aspartic acid or tribulus, or even cocktails like, you know, like Bioletics makes one called Optimale that may be able to naturally bump up your testosterone levels. And at the same time, make sure you're on what's called an aromatase inhibitor to make sure that testosterone isn't converted into excess estrogens. So that can be helpful as well. And then kind of the biggie here that it sounds kind of simple and stupid, but write down what you eat. Because in many, many cases, even if you're eating a super, super healthy diet, you're just eating an extra, you know, 200, 300, 500 calories a day, and you're never putting your body in a state where there are significant calorie deficits. And that's necessary to break through the barrier a lot of the time, is simply getting to the point where you're tapping into that storage energy. So, you know, lots of different variables there, but that's where I would start the detective work in terms of why your body fat isn't going down as quickly as you'd like. So Woohoo. I think that was it for the questions.
That was it. That's the last one. And not to be too Stuart Smalley or anything on you guys, but but like Josh and Jennifer and everybody else out there who's like, just if you spend all that time standing and looking at yourself in the mirror and sort of poking at your fat, and I know I do it, and I get mad at myself, but you have to remember to balance that out with just recognizing what you are good at and what you do have sort of genetically gifted to you. I know with me, if I look at extra calories, it goes straight to my belly. Just directly right there. But I know that in the past and right now, my arms and my shoulders, all I have to do is look at weights, and they bulk up, they look really good, they react really well to just doing moderate amounts of exercise. So I may have a little bit of extra fat on my stomach, and that's a genetic, I guess, a problem, but I've got some advantages too, and I encourage you to do the same thing. Look at what you've got as an advantage, not just your disadvantages. Mm.
I'm good. I'm great. I'm wonderful. And gosh darn it. People like me.
Exactly.
Well, cool. Well, I think we should wrap it up there. Folks, all the show notes and everything we talked about, you can access in podcast number 186 at bengreenfieldfitness.com. Be kind and leave a ranking or rating in iTunes. Be sure, if you have or know of a fitness or nutrition related business that would like tons of exposure by sponsoring Get Fit Guy's Guide to Achieving Your Ideal Body, that you check out the sponsorship perks that we're going to throw in as a download in this week's show notes at podcast number 186. Mm-hmm. And until next time, this is Ben and Brock wishing you a healthy week.
One more time. I am Iron Man.
Get the inside edge from Ben Greenfield Fitness delivered straight to your phone. Just text the word fitness to 411247 and you'll instantly get exclusive VIP discounts and insider tips that no one else will ever see except you. Do it now. Text the word fitness to 411247 and you'll be in Ben's VIP text club for free.